Press, read by Catriona Young.
Schoolgirl Curran Sanderson, aged 15, of Rotherham, was back with her family today after sparking a police alert by leaving home rather than watch Des O'Connor on TV.
Well, thank you, Mrs. E. Glasgow of York, for sending us that. And now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first on my right, Richard Ingrams and Peter Cook. Facing them on my left, Alan Corran and Tony Banks. Before we start round one, here's a tale from the Wiltshire Gazette and Herald.
A drunken reveller who hitched a 20-mile ride on the buffers of a freight train is to be prosecuted for travelling without a ticket. The man climbed on at Reading and was spotted at Didcot station when he shouted to staff on the platform, "Does this stop at Swindon?"
Thank you, Bridget Harpham of Causton, for sending that one in. Richard, question. Which father is now also a daddy?
He's not actually a father, is he, at all?
No, he's a
bishop.
That's right.
But he is a father in the sense
he is a father. Yes, he's
having
fathered
a beautiful child, which
well, I didn't think he was very beautiful. I think he's rather nasty.
The child?
The child is, and that awful woman.
I didn't know there was a woman involved as well.
I think there has to be, Peter. I'm not.
No, I'd be out of the country. I wouldn't know about that.
I'm not altogether sure of that. Anyway, it's poor old Bishop Casey who fell in with this ghastly old bat, Mrs. whatever her name is. There you are.
Well, you've certainly got us off to a flying start.
One thing led to another, Barry. I'll leave it at that.
But I feel it is very gracious of him to pay up through church funds. And having been found out, to admit it, that was terribly brave.
Yes, indeed. This is Eamon Casey, the Catholic Bishop of Galway, who, it seems, has been delivering his Sermon on the Mount. And the Pope gave Eamon Paternity Casey a stiff dressing down, as if he wasn't in enough trouble already, and told him to pull his socks up and any other items of clothing. But in the eyes of the Catholic Church, it could have been a lot, lot worse. At least the bishop can prove he hadn't used a condom. Well, that completes the good taste round. Peter, your question now. Who gave the royal we?
Well, my goodness me. The royal we, I think, was Her Majesty.
It was.
In a controversial speech in which she admitted that she was Queen of England and that Europe was over there and good luck to them.
I think you've got the nub of it there, Pete.
Oh, so I certainly have. I'll try and get out of this rotten Irish accent. It's something normal.
Yes. Absolutely right. It's Elizabeth II's speech to the European Parliament in Strasbourg, the one she had to delay until after the abdication of Queen Margaret. Tony, your question now. What knight heralded a Norman conquest?
I think that must be something to do with the new chairperson of the Conservative Party, Sir Norman Fowler. Who, when I remember in 1989, I think it was, quit as a cabinet minister saying that he wanted to spend more time with his family. Obviously, his family didn't want to spend more time with him, and he's now been made chairman of the Conservative Party.
Absolutely right. It's the new chairman of the Conservative Party, Sir Norman Fowler, appointed as John Major's election campaign minder on the grounds that he's the only man in Britain who makes the Prime Minister look colourful. The chairman must now work to ensure the factors which swept the Conservatives to victory in 92 are in place for the next election. The recession is still with us, unemployment is worsening. All he needs to do is to raise interest rates, and the fifth term's in the bag. Now, Alan, strangely, here's a piece of music for you.
Coi minero, gildu kero, coi minero, coi mi. Plim, slim, slam, a little darabona ring, ting a ring, dum, bulla dum, coi.
That Irish bishop, isn't it?
No, no, no. It's the one about Elizabeth Taylor making a comeback as a drunk in this new film.
It was a Channel Island folk song, actually. It was sung by Adolphus Leroux. And the question is, who are channeling their efforts against English rule?
Oh, well, it's the unreconstituted Nazis of the Channel Islands. Having got a taste for it during the war, they've now got some petit poujadi, some little ratbag, who's threatened the authority of the Queen. I saw him on television, lots of big blonde women. You'd think he was a bishop. Big blonde women standing behind him and urging him on with strange cries. It was very like the Third Reich. I think he'll take the Sudetenland tomorrow, but at the moment, he's got one of these bizarre things like the third stick of Sark. You know, the odd names these freaks have. And he's taking over the island, hip and thigh. Very bad news.
He's actually a judge.
It's a judge. Well, it's even worse.
His crime is that he was taking his cases too slowly, I think. Any judge like that.
It's very, very hard to believe, isn't it?
Well, it is.
Taking it too slowly.
I believe it is.
But he is actually.
Because St. Helier was the patron saint of tardiness, if I remember.
Absolutely right, Alan. It's the revolting satellite state of Jersey where Whitehall's sacking of local judge Vernon Tomes saw the downtrodden masses of oppressed millionaires and tax exiles taking to the streets in protest. One Jersey freedom fighter compared English rule to the German occupation and has started offering bed and breakfast for pilots in his loft. Another spent all morning turning around road signs and all afternoon trying to find his way home. And the scores at the end of the first round are, as always on this programme, 4-4. Before we start round two, here's an item from the Kenilworth Weekly News, sent to us by Brian Woods Scorn of Kenilworth.
Elizabeth the chef's bakery was broken into on Sunday night. Nothing was stolen, but a leg was bitten off a gingerbread man.
Richard. Whose legal judgment was judged legally the worst?
This is not Judge Tomes, but it was another judge who won the top marks in the Worst Judge of the Year competition. And his name is Mr. Justice Harmon.
Quite correct.
And he's famous for two things. One is for saying in a case, "Who is Jimi Hendrix?" That was his first claim to fame.
Who is it?
Well, I still don't know myself. And the other was more recently when, during the Maxwell affair, he came out and kicked a taxi driver in the shins. And he said, "Oh, well, it's all right, because I thought he was a journalist."
Absolutely. This is all about Mr. Justice Harmon, who was voted least respected High Court judge of 1992, and he was up against some pretty stiff competition this year. In an event a bit like Miss World, except the judges wear sexier underwear and the girls understand the meaning of appeal. Justice Harmon said that if he won, he hoped to travel, work with old people and find them guilty. Peter, what doomweed proved to be all washed up?
Doomweed?
Doomweed.
Doomweed.
The Cumbrian coast looms in the
sun. Oh dear, the doomweed was all washed up by the radiation field. I have no idea, Barry, but I'm willing to spin it out for a while in the hope that my educated friend Richard Ingram will jump in with the answer.
I will. It was the seaweed upon the beach. It wasn't in Scotland, was it?
No.
No thinking of Prince Charles.
I was doing that for security reasons.
Very ingenious.
I was asked by Mossad to disguise my voice. But you know the answer, don't fool with us.
It's the seaweed on the beach at Sellafield.
That's right.
Which is perfectly safe to eat.
Except it was ticking at the time.
That's absolutely right. It's a Sellafield nuclear plant in Cumbria which found itself coming under attack from an invasion of the glowing hydroids, which are seaweed-like organisms and not what you get from sitting on cold surfaces. The contaminated material was washed up on a beach near the power station, though a spokesman for British Nuclear Fuels said, "We don't know if they have any connection with Sellafield at all, really." Yes, the seaweed, 1,000 times more radioactive than normal, could have come from any one of the dozens of nuclear power stations which litter the Sellafield coastline. Tony, here's a piece of music for you. Was Summer Holiday, sung by Kevin the Gerbil. The The question is, who went off together on separate holidays?
Well, when I think of holidays, I always think of the Duchess of York, because she's always going on them. But I suspect it was another uniquely twinned royal set, Charles and Diana.
That's right.
It's very sad. She keeps getting photographed against these seven wonders of the world, which are all extremely large, even larger than her, and she's bound to look lonely. It's very sad. It was Taj Mahal last time. It's a Sphinx. It'll be the Colossus at Rhodes. His frail, suffering wife, while he's off picking his nose in Turkey or somewhere.
It's about time we had a photograph of him in a skimpy black bathing costume.
It's in the week that the Duchess of York made a visit to Britain. All her in-laws decided to get out of the country. Charles and Diana greeted each other at the airport with a traditional royal call of, "Don't I know you from somewhere?" before finding that, due to some silly airline booking error, they were both on the same flight. Anyway, Alan, here's your question. Whose weightless endeavours succeeded eventually?
Oh, these are the 24-hour plumonauts, called out by NASA and up there with their bicycle and ladder. And they cocked it up twice, and eventually they got hold of this thing manually and yanked it into... have they come down yet? I mean, is it dangerous to make jokes about these unfortunate fools who are up there? But they're pulling these all bits together so we can watch the Olympics.
Right.
Apparently it's the high-jump satellite or something. It's a very small cog in the great Olympic wheel, and they've got to get it back or they'll all look very silly.
It's the rogue satellite, which is orbiting the Earth at more than 20,000 miles away from where it should be, a bit like the Duchess of York, I suppose. After suffering what scientists call a booster rocket overdrive malfunction, which in layman's terms translates as flat battery, John. Intelsat 6 was rescued by astronauts from the space shuttle Endeavour in an operation so tense you could have heard a pin float. A 4-ton state-of-the-art multi-million-dollar telecommunications satellite was wrestled into the cargo bay for repairs after first being secured by a piece of equipment which scientists call a long pole with a small hook on the end. The scores at the end of the second round are still tied at 8-all. We start round three with a cutting from the Yorkshire Evening Post.
John Munden has turned the tables on his arch-rival Tony Quinn in their race to be the last name in the Leeds telephone directory. Tony's telephone name of Zachariah Zuckpster, which was bottom of the lists in the 1991 directory, only managed second to bottom place this time around, as John pipped him at the post with the name of Zebedee Zit.
Well, thank you, Anne Blaine from London, for sending us that. Richard, your question again. What thinly disguised feasts do a fat lot of good?
I think we've probably shot our boat as far as answering these questions. We've done awfully well so far.
I don't like to go into a sort of a triumphalist mood, but I think it's something to do with these awful ready-to-wear...
Ready-to-wear?
Ready-to-wear oven bake, bung in the oven, freeze-dried, smaller portions, foodstuffs, which can be bought at any supermarket. And their slimming achievement is because there's far less of them than normal. It's just a rotten old bit of stuff, but less of it, I think, is the answer.
Oh. You summed it up awfully well. It's the news that healthy, low-calorie, ready-prepared meals make you fat, especially if you eat 20 a day. An examination by the Connery Protection Group revealed that labels such as controlled sodium actually means quite salty, and high in fibre means, frankly, a bit stringy. The food processors responded that the report was poorly conducted, incomplete and misleading, but shredded into a bowl with added cardboard and bits of gravel, it makes highly nutritious, fat-free muesli. Peter, you were so good on that. Have a listen to this.
Raphaël, Raphaël, dans ses bras soupire-t-elle, avec lui tant de zèle, ne jamais exceptionnel, mais il se lasse et ça casse, vite une autre la remplace, infidèle au plus belle, ce n'est pas un Saint Raphaël, non pas un Saint Raphaël.
And la question est quoi?
Whose artistic fortune didn't have a renaissance?
Well, I think it was that Raphael, or not Raphael, which was unearthed from an attic somewhere, and has been displayed to the world's press and art critics. It looks rather nice to me. It's like that little boy crying. If it's not a fake, it certainly manages to be better than one. I think somebody's trying to talk up the price of something he bought for sixpence.
Yeah. In fact, the only thing is that you can see all the numbers underneath. But he bought it for 360 quid or something and said it's worth 10 million, or did he buy it for 10 million and it's now worth 360 quid? It's something like that, anyway.
It's part of the entrepreneurial society, Tony. Why can't you learn?
Well, I think Tony deserves a bonus for that. It's all certainly about an amateur art collector and professional self-publicist, Lester Winwood, who tried to convince the public and press that a painting he bought for 360 quid is in fact a £10 million Raphael Madonna.
Nice one.
Asked for his educated opinion, the editor of Art Review magazine used all his cultural fine art expertise to produce a critique of the picture and pronounced that it absolutely stinks. Tony, what election fight turned out to be an election fight?
Oh, this was in the Italian parliament, where Mussolini's daughter, I think...
Granddaughter,
encouraged a number of very nasty fascist types to go round hanging people upside down off lampposts, and they got into a big fight anyway. It sort of reminded me of the British parliament in its quieter moments. We got a few fascists in the British Parliament, of course, that they're just somewhat more deeply embedded there rather than sort of strutting around with their jackboots on, as they do apparently in the Italian Parliament.
They didn't have Mrs. Boothroyd to keep them in control.
Well, I think when you say fascist types, you mean well-dressed entrepreneurs.
Well, it's the same thing, yeah.
Yes, it's fighting which broke out among Italian MPs who gathered in the Rome Parliament to vote in the bi-weekly presidential election. Bubbly, vivacious, neo-fascist Alessandra Mussolini put her fingers in her mouth and let out a series of ear-piercing whistles. Alessandra Mussolini put her fingers in her mouth to let out a series of ear-piercing whistles. Funny, it doesn't get a laugh when you do it, eh? But stayed well clear of the flying fists, exhibiting a degree of restraint which would have had our grandfather turning on his lamppost. Alan, who climbed into the top 30?
Climbed into the top 30? You're not talking about the Everest, are you? Oh, that... Don't say no, because he's nodding.
I'm trying to help you.
When we were little and opened our atlases, it said Everest was 29,002 feet. It's a lot more than that now, because it's got all these hamburgers and things on it. 30 people went up last week in various different expeditions, including a woman. Yes, well-named rook shop. And it's absolutely filthy up there. It's terrible. Every time they come down, it's actually higher than it was before, because of all the junk, so they have to keep on climbing it, because it's... it's a higher mountain than the highest mountain in the world after they've climbed the one that was.
It was Mount Everest's busiest single day when 30 climbers made it to the summit to desperate shouts of, "Stop pushing at the back!" Sir Edmund Hillary complained the mountain was being ruined by overcrowding. It was a bit like Christopher Columbus moaning about all those people who went to America. And the scores at the end of round three have changed very slightly because Richard and Peter have well earned 12, but Alan and Tony have crept into the lead with 13. Before we start the final round, here's a cutting from the Daily Star.
Gunman robbed a drive-in cinema at Fort Wayne, Indiana, as it screened the film Drive-In, about a hold-up at a drive-in cinema.
Richard, here's a piece of music for you. Black Sheep by the Singing Sheep. The question is, who advertised the fact they had something to bleat about?
Well, I think this may be Prince Charles.
Indeed, but I don't think it is.
I don't think I've read any sheep stories.
Was this something to do with someone who answered an advertisement for a battery recharger or something and was sent a
sheep?
Blown up sheep, which I understand people use as a sex aid. Though I, what do you do with it? Perhaps Richard or Peter could tell us, but I...
Well, I think we leave that to the bishop.
Was that it?
That is it. Let me tell you
trust
what about
a
it.
A member of Parliament to know about that.
Give him a bonus for that. He deserves it. Yes, it's about the Southport couple who were invited to buy an inflatable sheep sex aid after answering an advertisement for rechargeable batteries in that salacious Topshelf publication, The Daily Telegraph. They received a mail shot inviting them to buy a Love You for the bargain price of £17.95. A drawing was accompanied by the description, "She has been developed to bring the joy of sheep into your love life without the obvious problems of a real sheep." No bleating to alert the neighbours. No risk of ruining your prize lawn, among other things. This came as a severe disappointment to the unnamed duo, and even more of a disappointment to the lonely ram in Derbyshire who got the batteries.
Ram bang, thank you, ma'am.
Dear me. Peter, your question. Who swore herself in at college?
Who swore herself in at college?
Princess Princess Margaret. It's the dirty newsreader, the lady newsreader, who was in the debate.
Yes, delightful Pamela Armstrong.
Absolutely so.
Delightful Pamela Armstrong, who said, "I started at the bottom and I kissed it."
So she did.
Was she involved with the sheep as well?
It's a surprising story, really. It's the BBC's very own Pamela Armstrong, who gave a speech at a college union debate, which brought a whole new meaning to the expression Cambridge Blue. Students were shocked by the World Service broadcaster's broad language, which left something to be desired, like a single word that could actually be broadcast on the World Service. Listeners may be interested to know that a cassette tape is available with the offensive bits bleeped out. Mind you, it sounds just like half an hour of the Greenwich Time signal. Tony, your question again. Whose first-class payment is worth threepence?
Ooh. That's got me there.
Very strange.
This first-class payment. Come on, you brains.
No, do I?
Yes, is that
brilliant? Train story, is it?
No, it's not. It's a
stamp story.
It's a DSS story.
Oh, it'll be someone whose benefits are only threepence after. Years, many years. He's been somewhere.
She
has been.
Or
married. Yeah. This is a woman who's been living with a sheep for some years. And this doesn't actually count as a form of common law marriage within the meaning of the Act. And in the great shakedown, her benefits are only threepence. No, we're not going to get anywhere.
I'll tell you what it is.
Is it the government's proposal that everyone on DSS is going to get threepence?
Might be the thin end of the wedge. Anyway, it's grandmother Motty Ben Harrier, who is being paid a state pension of threepence a week, an amount which shocked the retired shop assistant as, under present benefit rules, it was more than twice what she'd expected. The Department of Social Insecurity sends the threepence cheque to her by post with a first-class 24-pence stamp every week. Prompt payment that allows Mrs. Harrier to buy all of life's necessities, such as a tenth share of a pint of milk, and for a treat, the odd bag of chip. The 60-year-old from North London has written a letter of appeal to the DSS tribunal, and she is currently saving for a stamp to post it. Should mean her case is taken up in July of 1996. Alan, what early riser has got something to crow about?
This is another barnyard filth story, isn't it?
Yes.
This is from Biddeford, not a million miles from Torbay. In fact, it's probably the only lively and still virile thing in the area. It's a cockerel called Corky. And he's got 14 hens. And unlike a bishop, every time it does anything that it needs to with these hens, it cries out, rattles the rafters, and the bloke next door who moved in wasn't a rural man at all, was some fearful executive type, had moved in next door and was startled by this display of overt sexuality from across the fence. And he took out an order or an injunction, whatever you do with a noise abatement rat bags on faceless people they have down in Biddeford. And they've stopped this cockerel from doing it. But all the people gather together. It's just like the Channel Island story. The local people banded together and have given the cockerel its rights back. But I think, if I remember rightly, it has to keep away from the hens.
It's absolutely
or it will
right,
come huh? up before the beak. It wasn't me, it was a headline in The Sun. No, it wasn't, it was me. Sorry.
This refers to Corky the cockerel from Devon, who can crow to his heart's content after a magistrate overturned a council decision to curtail his dawn chorus. A neighbour had complained that it was waking him up too early in the morning, especially when Corky's owner put the bird back an hour to mark the beginning of British summertime. Well, before we reveal the final scores, let's see what cuttings the team have brought along. Richard, have you got something amazing?
Well, one of my colleagues on the Odie drew my attention to an unusual headline in the Daily Mirror last week. It says, "Man throws Rottweiler into car full of Asians." "But I'm not a bigot," he says.
Peter, what have you got?
One of my live-in lovers from Private Eye drew to my attention something from the Wrexham and Moco Mail. Thieves broke into the B&Q store on Burst Road, Wrexham, on Wednesday. After deactivating the burglar alarm, the thieves got away with a quantity of burglar alarms.
Tony, what have you got, Ruth?
This is a cutting about said bishop that we've been having a bit of fun with. Well, someone's had some fun with him, that's for sure. Bishop Joseph Duffy of Clure, the church's official spokesman in Ireland, refused to speculate whether there would be an inquiry into the scandal. Last night, Dr. Casey was reported to be in El Salvador, Central America, where he plans to act in some sort of missionary position. It must be true, because it's from the News of the World, May the 10th.
Alan, what have you brought?
Oh, it can only get worse. It's exactly the same sort of thing. It's from the Daily Mail on Tuesday. Says, "Wearing a lace garter over black stockings, miniskirted Sheila Ford kept a date yesterday at the High Court. Dressed as a French maid, 35-year-old Miss Ford was told that prostitutes do have to pay income tax. She claimed that money earned illegally was not subject to such deductions. Unmoved, Mr. Registrar James made a bankruptcy order for £44,000 due on immoral earnings, which the Inland Revenue estimated £150,000 a year. Announcing that she would appeal, Miss Ford said, 'Don't think I'm taking this lying down.'"
Well, thank you. Let's look at the final scores, which, well, I thought you were going to make it, chaps, but tradition has, I'm afraid, won again, because Richard and Peter have got a terrific 15, but Alan and Tony an even better 16, and win not only this programme, but the series. Before we leave you, here's news from the Eastern Daily Press, sent to us by R. Lansell of King's Lynn.
Several people needed hospital treatment yesterday after an explosion at an Indian restaurant. A Scotland Yard spokesman said the blast wasn't believed to be suspicious and was being treated as a possible gas explosion.
Goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Richard Ingrams, Alan Corran, Peter Cook and Tony Banks. The chairman was Barry Took and the news was read by me, Katrina Young. The programme was written by Ian Pattinson and Robert Fraser-Steele, and the producer was Colin Swash.